Michael Whiting was born in Belo Horizonte, Brazil, and raised in Provo, Utah. He received his B.S. degree in zoology from BYU in 1990 and his Ph.D. from Cornell University in 1995. And let me just add as a footnote that he comes from a BYU family. His brother is a member of the faculty in statistics, and his father is an emeritus member of the faculty in communications. He joined the faculty in the Department of Zoology at BYU in 1997 and is currently an associate professor in the Department of Integrated Biology. He also serves as director of the BYU DNA Sequencing Center and as associate curator in the Anthropods collection of the Moniel Bean Life Science Museum. Dr. Whiting's research focuses on using DNA and anatomical information to elucidate patterns of evolution among major insect groups. Current research focuses on establishing the insect tree of life. Many of his publications, he has 60 publications in major journals, including Nature, Evolution, and Systematic Biology. He's also the author of over 100 research presentations at scientific meetings. He has served on review panels for the National Science Foundation and currently serves on the editorial board of 3 scientific journals. He's received the Career Award from the National Science Foundation, the Ernst Mayr Award from the Society of Systematic Biologists, and the Presidential Award from the Entomological Society of America, as well as the Young Investigator Award from Brigham Young University. He's had what we call a fast start in his professional career. Professor Whiting and his wife are the parents of a 2-year-old daughter named Adeline. Professor Whiting.
Thank you for that kind introduction. I'm pleased to speak to you today and share with you a little bit of the enthusiasm that I have for the work I do at Brigham Young University. The first thing you should know about me is that I am an entomologist. That is, I'm someone who studies bugs. Insects have fascinated me for as long as I can remember. My mother recalls that when I was being delivered in a South American hospital, there were large beetles crawling up and down the walls, and that made her very nervous. She is certain that this experience is somehow related to my entomological interests. One of my earliest memories is of a stick insect that was evading my attempts to capture it. Even in high school, I was given the nickname of Bugs. It's hard to imagine anyone who was more predestined to study insects than I was. But how could you not love bugs? Nature is complex, beautiful, and full of a wide diversity of forms. And in no places is this more apparent than one takes a moment to contemplate the insect. One cannot look at insects without being amazed at their sheer beauty, their stunning colors, and their bizarre forms. But biological diversity is not a random assemblage of forms. There is order and pattern to nature. Much of science lies in documenting the patterns we observe in nature and then postulating processes that may account for those patterns. Let me give you a simple example. This is a picture of my daughter, Adeline, at lunchtime about a year ago. And what I want you to notice is how nice and clean her tray is. Now, anyone who has children recognizes that this particular pattern of cleanliness is short-lived at best. Now, if I were to walk out of the room for a moment and walk back in, I would observe a striking new pattern. And so we see chocolate smears with vestiges of mangled teddy bear crackers, sort of artistically sprinkled throughout. Now, this is a pattern, a much more interesting pattern than observed before. Now, as a parent, your first thought is, I've got to clean it up. But as a scientist, I'm left to wonder, what processes gave rise to this pattern? Notice, I'm not asking who gave rise to this pattern. I'm pretty confident I know the culprit here. I'm only interested in discovering the specific processes associated with forming this particular pattern. How did she do it? For instance, I might hypothesize that the ridges of pudding present in the middle of the picture were created by finger smearing as opposed to, let's say, elbow smearing or face smearing. Well, on collecting additional data, I am able to confirm the finger smearing hypothesis, though I suppose it does not rule out the face smearing hypothesis. Now, Remember, I was not there. I did not see it happen, but I can infer something about a process in the past by carefully examining the pattern that remains. Pattern provides evidence for deciphering process. Now, the notion that patterns exist in nature and that they can be organized in a regular and orderly fashion is not a new idea. Aristotle was a keen observer of nature, and he thought deeply and profoundly about how his observation should be sensibly organized. He thought that all of nature could be organized into a ladder, the systema naturae. At the base of this ladder are the simple plants that were not much different from non-living matter. At the pinnacle was a human species, and each group of organisms had a place within the hierarchy that roughly corresponded to their level of complexity. But it was a ladder and not an escalator. There was no notion that any species could transform into any other, nor was there any idea of progression. There was a place for every species, and every species had its place. Now let us jump to the 17th century and consider for a moment a body of thought that became prevalent with the writings of John Ray. Ray was a Cambridge professor who championed the idea of natural theology. Natural theology taught that by studying the creation, one can learn about the attributes and characteristics of the Creator. Living things showed adaptations to their environments, which for Ray were signs of God's design and benevolence. So why does a lion have sharp claws? It is because God could not let lions go hungry. Why do the birds sing in the trees? It is because they are singing the praises of a just Creator. We just sang, "All creatures of our God and King, lift up your voice and with us sing." Ray affirmed powerfully that nature was a worthy subject for study and reason, and that such activity was pleasing to God. Ray, of course, was not the first natural theologian, and we have from Alma a similar sentiment. "Yea, and all things denote that there is a God. Yea, even the earth and all the things that are upon the face of it. Yea, and its motion. Yea, and also all the planets, which move in their regular form, do witness that there is a supreme Creator." Hence, according to Alma, one purpose of the creation is to be a witness for the Creator. This brings us next in our whirlwind tour to Charles Darwin. Here on the left, we see him pictured as a 7-year-old in 1816, posing with one of his beloved flowers. On the right, we see what the rigors of science does to one's features over time. And you will notice he was allowed to have a beard, by the way. Darwin was born 12th of February, 1809, in Shrewsbury, England. This was the same day that Abraham Lincoln was born, in only 3 years after the birth of Joseph Smith. Now, these three men, Smith, Lincoln, and Darwin, were all contemporaries who profoundly changed mankind's view of religion, politics, and science. Darwin was, in fact, influenced by many of the same religious and social pressures that Joseph Smith was. And some of the same social forces which molded Joseph Smith and the early church were also operating on Darwin. It is interesting that these men were contemporaries during a time when the Lord saw fit to rain down knowledge upon the earth. Now, Charles Darwin provided profound insights into the nature of nature. He saw what everyone else saw, but provided a new way of putting all of this information together. He was a meticulous observer and managed to digest and synthesize a tremendous amount of information. The theories he produced continue to influence everything we do in biology today. Now, I might mention here that one often hears Darwin portrayed as a man eager to destroy faith and tear down religion. Often these are the same detractors who paint Joseph Smith and the history of the church with a similar paintbrush. But this caricature is not true to the record. Certainly the ideas that sprung from Darwin's work had a profound influence on religious thought and still continue to do so. But by all accounts, Darwin was a loving father, a kind man, afraid of confrontation, and someone who would much rather study the mining habits of earthworms than be involved in a debate over science and religion. Well, those who know a little bit about Darwin's history will recognize the historic voyage of the HMS Beagle and the role that Darwin played as the ship's naturalist. It was this 5-year period during which Darwin collected the initial observations that would chart the course for the rest of his work. This was a grueling voyage, and Darwin kept a precise and fascinating record. I imagine you're all acquainted with his stop in the Galapagos Islands and the unusual organisms he found there. He saw flightless birds, There were penguins and sea lions frolicking together. There were iguanas which grazed on marine algae, and finches which varied in beak size across the islands. And of course, the island's namesake, the giant tortoise. Now, in case you're a bit confused here, this is not Darwin on the tortoise. This is me at age 5 contemplating, much as Darwin did, what all these patterns might mean. And standing there next to the door is my brother, the statistician. And I think there's some sort of metaphor here, but I'm not sure what it is. Darwin returns to England in 1836 and continues his work of observing patterns. Now, during the next 23 years, he spent his time trying to understand what all of these patterns mean. In 1859, he goes ahead and he publishes The Origin of Species, which is jam-packed with observations and the connections he tries to make between these observations. The species illustrated here are just some of the many he discusses on his chapter on natural selection. For the first time, someone was trying to draw a connection between the jaws of a stag beetle, the ornate feathers of the peacock, the blooming patterns of plums, and the behavior of honeybees. He was postulating a process to explain a pattern. Well, so what processes did Darwin hypothesize? You're probably familiar with them. This is a slide from my wedding. This is my immediate family, a happy family of 10. You can tell it's my wedding picture. I don't know if you can actually see this, but if you look carefully, you'll see that there are bug nets with flowers in the upper corners. And my mother is sitting there on the right. Well, this is my family. Now, this is my mother's brother and his family at a similar time and similar occasion. I can't count them all, but I can tell you that we're outnumbered. Darwin recognized that some individuals were more successful at leaving offspring than other individuals. And he recognized the implications of this simple math. So according to Darwin, my uncle is much more successful than my mother. Sorry, Mom. And isn't it ironic that this is the same conclusion that many Mormons might draw? Now, Darwin also recognized, as all mothers do, that not all the kids are the same. And this is true throughout all of nature. In any given species, there is variation in characteristics and behaviors which lead to differential survival. In other words, not everybody makes it. If you are an eager beaver who tends to stand on the wrong side of the tree, you might not make it. This is natural selection. This is the slide I use to motivate students in my class. Now, one of Darwin's key insights was that the old Aristotelian system of organizing species into a ladder does not fit the patterns of biological diversity he observed. Darwin suggested that a branching pattern that resembles a tree is a better comparison. He states the affinities of all the beings of the same class have sometimes been represented by a great tree. I believe this simile largely speaks the truth. So just as there is a giant pedigree which connects all humans, Darwin postulates a pedigree which connects all species. Now, here's a version of the tree of life illustrated in the late 19th century, which may be the sort of tree that you've seen before. Notice we have amoebas down at the bottom of the trunk of the tree, with insects coming off the right branch halfway up the tree, and mollusks come off the left branch. Darwin provides a vast array of insights into the biological world and is deservedly given the status of the most influential biologist of all times. Among his many contributions, Darwin pointed scientists towards using trees as the central organizing system in biology. We now believe that all species fit together into a single big tree, but exactly how the pieces fit together is still puzzling. This is because nature is diverse and the tools needed for reconstructing the tree of life required later technical advances. Charles Darwin gave us the tree of life, but some assembly is required. Think of it this way. Imagine you're out walking across a desert and you come upon a tree which is buried in the sand, so that only some branches and tips are exposed. Now, it is your task to determine what the entire tree looks like from only observing the tips and the branches sticking out of the sand. This is a difficult but not an impossible task. The sand represents time. The exposed leaves and branches are the species that are still around today, those which we can observe, and branches buried beneath the sand represent extinct species. It requires special tools to remove the sands of time, but we have these tools available to us. Digging reveals a great tree with all twigs and branches interconnected from a common trunk, and in the digging process, one often reveals buried treasure. Let me explain in the most general terms how we do the digging and reconstruct evolutionary trees. Okay, we're going to play a game here. And this is the game of which of these things is not like the other with some animal species. We will start off with three species and ask which two appear to be the most similar. In this example, I have selected a cougar, a chipmunk, and a chicken. It does not take an astute observer of nature to recognize that the chipmunk and cougar are more similar to each other than either is to the chicken. The chipmunk and cougar share a number of features lacking in chickens, such as the presence of hair, mammary glands, and other features. So we can diagram this relationship by putting a circle around the chipmunk and the cougar and indicate that it is the shared presence of hair which supports this relationship. I can diagram the same relationship by drawing a tree with the chipmunk and the cougar joined together by two branches that meet, with the chicken placed outside on a separate branch. This diagram tells us the same information as the circles above. Okay, for fun, let's add a lizard and ask, where is this thing going to sit in relation to the other three species? Now, those of you who are herpetologists and ornithologists would recognize that lizards and chickens both have scales. Chickens have them on their legs, and lizards, they just have them all over. Thus, we can draw a circle around the chicken and lizard and indicate that they form a group based on the presence of scales. Furthermore, we can say that all four species as a group share the characteristic of the amnion being present. The amnion is a membrane that protects the egg from drying out, which helped vertebrates move from water to land. Just as above, we can represent this relationship in tree-like form by joining the chicken and lizard with scales supporting their union, and the presence of an amnion supporting the grouping of all four species. So we are beginning to build a respectable tree. Okay, let's do it one more time. Let's add this cute little green frog. The frog has neither hair nor scales nor an amnion, so it is placed by itself outside of the group, uniting the four other species. In the tree diagram below, this corresponds to placing it at the base of the tree. Now, all of these species are tetrapods. That is, they all have four limbs, so we can indicate this feature on the tree. So now we have a tree with the frog at the base, the chicken and the lizard in one group, and the chipmunk and cougar in another group. Now, the example I just gave you is pretty straightforward. We all know the differences between mammals, chickens, lizards, and frogs, so making a tree is not that difficult. There are many cases, however, where anatomical features provide little help, and this is where DNA evidence comes in. If we were to characterize the DNA of these species, we could use shared similarities in the DNA sequences to build a tree in the same way that we used anatomical features. DNA provides another set of evidence to support a particular tree. Okay, so I've taken you through this long example. Now that we have this tree, what can we do with it? Well, we can use it to build a classification system and say that our tree suggests that the chipmunk and the cougar should be combined into a single group, which we might call mammals. But we can also use this tree to answer some perplexing questions. I'm about to answer a riddle with which all of you are familiar. No doubt this has perplexed you at one time or another. In fact, it is such a classic conundrum that it has become a metaphor for any sort of question which evades solution. So let me ask you this question. Which came first, the chicken or the egg? Well, let me show you. The chicken came here. This is the branch leading to chickens. The egg came here. The egg was first. The egg is present in the chicken and the lizard, and in a modified form, the egg is present in all mammals. So from an evolutionary standpoint, there were eggs present long before there were chickens. The amniotic egg, the type of egg a chicken has, was present in the common ancestor to mammals, birds, and lizards, but not present in frogs. And it developed long before the chicken did. This is an example of how a tree of life can answer difficult questions. The tree establishes patterns. And once the patterns are in place, we can ask questions and resolve issues that could never be addressed otherwise. It is no different than looking at a smear of pudding on a tray and using that pattern to select among alternative processes. The centrality and importance of assembling the tree of life is now finally broadly recognized within science. For basic biological research, we can ask chicken and egg types of questions. For scientists trying to save a threatened species, a tree of life helps us decide which species are the most critical to save to maintain biological diversity. For an epidemiologist trying to predict the outbreak and spread of HIV, a tree of life helps decipher what viral forms are resistant to drug therapies. For a snake bite victim, the tree of life helps a doctor decide which anti-venom to use. 5 years ago, the National Science Foundation announced a program with the stated goal of assembling a tree of life for all known species. This is an ambitious goal. From a biologist's standpoint, it is equivalent to sending a man to the moon. This goal was unthinkable even a decade ago, but now work is underway across the country to assemble the tree of life, and BYU is playing a leading role in this endeavor. At BYU, we are assembling a tree of life for reptiles, nematode worms, insects, and we hope to soon begin on crustaceans and beetles. Since I work on the insects, let me tell you a little bit about how this is done. There are roughly 32 different major groups of insects that entomologists place into groups we call orders. So beetles make up one order. Flies, praying mantises, butterflies, and other insects each make up other orders. But despite being the most abundant group on the planet, we still know very little about who is related to whom. Everyone can tell the difference between a butterfly, a bee, and a beetle, but entomologists are still not sure which two are more closely related. So the first thing we do in my lab is we need to obtain specimens from around the world for our DNA analysis. This map represents some of the places that my lab group has been in the past 4 years, and we spend a tremendous time in the field catching bugs. We do DNA research, so we need to have nice, fresh specimens. Here are some pictures from our work in Papua New Guinea. On the top left, you can see the sort of pristine rainforest that we work in. On the top right, you can see one of the most populous highland villages we visited. On the bottom left, you can see the small Cessna airplane we use to get in and out of these remote villages. Now, these are rusty old machines, and they sound like one of those old Volkswagen Beetle cars. They cough and wheeze when they warm up. You're not sure whether they're actually going to make it. And I've got to tell you, it is a harrowing experience to be in one of these as they rattle down the grass airstrip and just manage to clear the forest canopy. Sitting next to me is my wife, Allison, who happens to be a herpetologist, and that's someone who studies reptiles. Now, whenever we have disagreements, I might mention, she reminds me that her creatures can eat my creatures. And there are a few things that test a marriage like 10 weeks in the rainforest together. In the bottom right is a colleague, Michael Hastrider, who came with us to catch fleas. And if you can notice, in the back, there's this dilapidated shack. Okay, that's the airport terminal. At least the security check-in was a breeze. And here are the fruits of our labors. I'm delighted with an afternoon's collection of walking sticks while Allison just beams from ear to ear with the lizard she collected. You have to love someone who gets so much joy from a dead lizard. As I mentioned earlier, these sorts of trips can be harrowing. Here you see a local woman we met during one of our long tracks who, when I showed an interest in her spread of weevil larvae, insisted that I partake. They do not taste like chicken. And here I am gazing upwards to heaven, seeking strength before performing the daily ritual of leech removal. These leeches are terrestrial, they occur on the trail, they get all over you, and despite our best efforts, they just latch on. Now, I'm not the only one who gets to have fun with leeches in the field. That's what students are for. And many of the students in my lab travel to exotic places, all in pursuit of very specialized and unusual insects. Pictured are some undergraduates, graduate students, and postdoctoral researchers who work in my lab, each of whom work on a specific branch of the insect tree of life. In the top picture is Katerina, who's surveying a bat cave in Mexico. Katerina works on a specialized kind of fly that only lives on the belly of bats, so she spends her time spelunking across the world. The bottom pictures show two graduate students who are in Tasmania pursuing a weird bug that feeds on moss in the snow. This is my graduate student, Gavin, dressed as a telephone repairman. He specializes in rainforest canopy collecting. And here he is setting up special traps to catch insects in the canopy in India. We are finding many new species that are unknown to science this way. We set up high-powered lights in the forest, and the insects often come pouring in, as in these pictures from a trip to Peru. Now, I know that for some of you, this constitutes a nightmare, but for us, this is a dream come true. And we also sometimes attract curious people. Once we bring the insects back to the lab, we sort, identify, and catalog what we have collected. The specimens are kept frozen in a very cold freezer to preserve DNA quality. In fact, and I'm not sure the administration recognizes this, but BYU has the largest frozen bug collection in the world. We should put that on a t-shirt and sell it at the bookstore. One of the reasons why BYU has become a center for the many Tree of Life projects is because of the excellent DNA sequencing resources available here. Here you see Johnny and Sarah, each happily processing DNA. Once the DNA sequences are generated, it takes a row of undergraduates to begin processing the data, and a row of graduate students to oversee the undergraduates. My lab uses postdoctoral researchers, graduate students, and undergraduates all working together as a team to conduct research on the insect tree of life. One result of this team effort is that these students get to present their research at national and international scientific meetings. The undergraduate students pictured here took home the top research awards from national insect meetings. This has helped secure outstanding, truly outstanding graduate opportunities for these students, and has given BYU the reputation of being an outstanding place to recruit students for the sciences. Now, as I mentioned earlier, one of the reasons why Darwin was unable to assemble a tree of life was because he lacked the technology necessary for such an enormous undertaking. We now live in a world of computers which help assemble and analyze the information needed to make a tree of life, but there is still one problem. It turns out that individual computers do not have sufficient computational power to analyze our deluge of data. One clever solution to this problem is being developed right here at BYU by Professors Quinn Snell and Mark Clement from the Computer Science Department. They have developed software applications which allow cluster computers, supercomputers, and idle desktop computers to communicate with each other and all work together on solving analysis problems. Thus, a second reason why BYU has become a center for assembling the Tree of Life is because of the excellent computational resources available to us. Now, what I want to do is just shift focus here a little bit and give you a quick overview of three projects to come out of my lab in an attempt to try and tie all of this together. The first project comes from the research of an undergraduate student, James, who left my lab last year and is pursuing a doctoral degree at the University of Georgia. James was interested in a group of insects known as pleasing fungus beetles. The reason why they are called fungus beetles is because they feed on fungi throughout the tropics. The reason why they are pleasing is because they are just so beautiful. Wouldn't you be pleased to find one of these? No, we didn't actually paint these beetles. This is how they look in nature. In fact, the Latin name given them is Aerotilidae, which translates to little darlings. So now you know how to call your sweetheart a little darling in Latin. Just lean over and whisper, Aerotilidae. Now, fungus beetles sequester toxins present in the fungi and place them in their own bodies as a defense against would-be predators. Biting into them is then like biting into a toxic mushroom. We think that the fancy colors help advertise their distaste to predators. James wanted to understand the evolution of color patterns in these beetles. He spent time in the field in Peru and other places. He collected lots of fungus beetles, sequenced their DNA, and made a tree. James discovered that body patterning does not follow strict genealogical lines. And this finding had implications for how these beetles develop and use their warning coloration in nature. This research helped James get into a graduate school, and it secured funding to pay for his entire education, not to mention turning the fungus beetle research community on its ear. Let's leave beetles and talk about mantids. Praying mantids are spectacular creatures. They're filled with style, charm, and charisma. Here are just a few examples of the glorious mantids. All mantids are predators, and there are about 3,000 species of them throughout the world. Mantids live in the tropics in the tops of the rainforest canopy, in the deserts where they run around on the ground after their prey, and in every conceivable bush or tree. My graduate student, Gavin, recognized that the predatory strategy of mantids fall into three basic categories. The first are the generalists. These are the mantids that are not too picky about how they get their meals and will catch them any way they can. The second are the cursorial mantids, which means that they run around on the ground and chase after their meal. The third are the sort of mantids that you are probably most familiar with, the ambush mantids. These are the ones that stalk their prey, hold very still, and then strike with lightning speed. The vast majority of mantid species use this ambush strategy. Gavin is trying to learn something about the evolution of this hunting behavior. He sequenced their DNA, he made a tree, and a pattern emerged. It appears that ambush mantids all came from a single ancestor who was also an ambush mantid, and that the development of an ambush lifestyle led to the radiation and diversification of mantids. In other words, when mantids first became ambush hunters, they hit upon a strategy that assured their success, which gave rise to many more mantid species than their less advanced cousins. This final example comes from my own research on walking sticks. Walking sticks, as their name implies, are insects shaped like leaves or sticks, and they use camouflage to fool predators into thinking that they are just bits of trees. When they move, they sway their bodies back and forth so that they look just like twigs moving in a breeze. Walking sticks come in two major forms. The first are those with wings, as pictured in this slide. On top is a large species. It's about the length of my forearm. And on the bottom is a leaf mimic. The leaf mimic species even has false veins and mold spots on its body to complete the illusion. And then there are walking sticks without wings. These are lovely creatures often found at the base of trees, and some are quite spectacular in size. Here you can see me holding a few species. I believe that science should indeed be hands-on. That's why I do it. Now, we know that walking sticks are relatively advanced insects, that they came from an ancestral insect that had wings. Here are some examples of some of the close relatives of stick insects, including roaches, mantids, and others. Since nothing was known about the walking stick tree of life, I began a project with the help of another undergraduate student to assemble one. When we assembled the tree, we found a very unexpected surprise. It turns out that walking stick phylogeny indicated a very unusual pattern. Primitive walking stick insects were actually wingless, and wings were only acquired later on during stick insect evolution. This was quite a shock because we know that the distant ancestor of stick insects had wings, and our results suggested that these wings were lost and subsequently regained later during stick insect evolution. To give you some perspective, to an entomologist, this is as shocking as if you were to observe a whale regrow its legs, get up out of the water, and start walking around. In standard evolutionary theory, you either use it or you lose it. It has been thought that if a particular structure no longer serves a function, then the underlying genes coding for that structure will also cease to function, and you cannot get that structure back again. It's rather like tearing down your home, ripping up the blueprints, and then asking someone to rebuild you an identical home from scratch. But our results suggest an additional evolutionary process, which helps maintain biological complexity over long periods of time. The details of the study are really not important here, and I won't elaborate on why our conclusion makes a lot of sense to evolutionary biologists. I simply wish to emphasize that the pattern seen in the stick insect tree of life provided us with new insights into evolutionary processes. You know, being an entomologist always leads to interesting conversations. When I visit new wards in my travel, I often get into conversations, and the typical conversation goes something like this. I'm asked, "What do you do for work?" I respond, "Well, you know, I study insects." Usually they raise an eyebrow and ask, "What is it about insects that you study?" I respond, "I study their genealogy or evolutionary relationships." "Well, who pays you to do that?" And I respond, "BYU." Their eyes open wide as saucers, their jaws drop, and I can tell what they're thinking. Their first thought is, "Does the church have some new family history program that I haven't heard of?" But invariably their second thought is, "How can you do that at BYU? Doesn't evolution teach things diametrically opposed to the teachings of the church?" No doubt some of you are thinking the same sort of thing. What is evolution? Well, to me, it is simply the scientific study of the underlying mechanics of the creative process. It studies the patterns of creation and seeks to define the processes which gave rise to these patterns. It does not preclude the existence of God, nor does it challenge his role in the creation. Recall the analogy of my daughter that I began with. I know who was responsible for smearing the food. I was only interested in how she did it. But by studying this pattern that she had created, I was able to learn an awful lot about her. She's messy. Or maybe she's creative. Or maybe she just really likes chocolate pudding. This is very much the way I view my own research. I know who is responsible for the creation, but my research just focuses on learning something about how it was done. I view my work in very much the same way as a natural theologian, where I seek to learn something about the Creator by studying the creation. Only I move it back one step by asking, what does the creative process teach me about the nature of the Creator? In the 1920s, there were about 400,000 species of beetles described, and this number was vastly larger than any other group of organisms. The naturalist J.B.S. Haldane was asked by a cleric about what he might infer about the Creator based on the wide-ranging study of life. Haldane replied, tongue-in-cheek, that the Creator had an inordinate fondness for beetles. So what have I learned about the nature of the Creator from my own studies? I will attempt to summarize it with this slide. This is a close-up of Tenocephalides felis, the cat flea. Look at how remarkable this organism is. It has combs on its head and legs to help it remain attached to the hair of the cat. It has mouth parts modified into an efficient pump, all the better to feed on its host with. It has the most amazing modifications of its hind legs, which permits it to jump to dizzying heights so it can move from one cat to the next. No one is more amazed with the complexity and beauty of a flea than I. To paraphrase the poet, I think that I shall never see a poem as lovely as a flea. Now, we often glory in the end products of the creative process, all the species which surround us and stun us with their vibrant colors, amazing behavior, and peculiar features. And we are right to do so. There is something that brings us closer to the divine by contemplating the grand diversity of life. We also glory in a benevolent creator and ascribe glory to him for all of this work. This is also right. However, I am not sure that we fully appreciate just how good a job he did in creating the earth. All of my studies lead me to believe that not only did the Lord create the earth, but that he did so in a supremely intelligent fashion. Consider for a moment DNA. You have four basic blocks which comprise the DNA molecule. From a biological standpoint, the only difference between every species that inhabits the planet is how these four blocks are arranged in long strings, like numbers in a telephone book. Alma was right. By small and simple things, our great things come to pass. Let me put it another way. I can admire a beautiful pot made from clay, and I can admire the potter who makes it. I can even study and understand the techniques the potter uses to take a shapeless lump of clay and turn it into a beautiful pot. But I cannot make a pot. And I marvel at the skill displayed when I watch a really excellent potter throw a really excellent pot. It's not as easy as it looks, and not just anyone can do it. So I admire the potter, the pot, and the skill required during the process to make a pot. I can likewise marvel at the skill of a creator who has made a very excellent creation in a very excellent way. I believe the Lord set certain laws in place which resulted in a world filled with diversity, beauty, and form, each species interacting with every other, tied together in a glorious whole. Now, I do not understand what all these laws are. This is why I study the things I do. But from what little I know, I'm left to rejoice in the intelligence behind the creation. I think that Charles Darwin felt a very similar sentiment from all of his studies. This is the very last sentence from his Origin of Species. You might be surprised by this. There is grandeur in this view of life, with its several powers having been originally breathed by the Creator into a few forms, or into one, and that whilst this planet has gone cycling on according to the fixed law of gravity, from so simple a beginning, endless forms most beautiful and most wonderful have been and are being evolved. Recall that Joseph Smith and Darwin were contemporaries. While Darwin was in the midst of his travels on the HMS Beagle, Joseph Smith received the following revelation. Yea, verily I say unto you, in that day when the Lord shall come, he shall reveal all things, things which have passed and hidden things which no man knew, things of the earth by which it was made, and the purpose and the end thereof, things most precious, things that are above and things that are beneath, things that are in the earth and upon the earth and in heaven. The Lord indicates that the day will come when we will learn all of these precious things, and he specifically mentions how the earth was made. However, I do not think that this verse means that we can learn nothing about creation until the Lord comes, and that we shouldn't try. To claim that we can learn nothing about the creative process in this life, to me, is the same as the claim that we can learn nothing about the nature of God until he comes. So what do we do? What do we do when some ideas in evolutionary theory seem to directly contradict the doctrines of the church? What do we do when people around us seem to be so unsettled and so disturbed by ideas they find hard to reconcile? Let me give you a suggestion. Perhaps we should be humble. Let's not get bent out of shape. Let's not insist that we must have all of the answers and have them now. Let's not demand that the Lord reveal it now or that the scientists stop studying it now. Let's stop thinking that we know more than we do. The Lord has not yet revealed the mechanics of creation. The scripture we just read confirms this. And scientists are still probing around in the dark the best we can to try and understand even the basics of the creative process. In the meantime, let's be humble and grateful to live in a world which inspires such deep contemplation. The world is beautiful and filled with the diversity of forms. My work leads me to believe that the creation was nothing short of miraculous, the Creator was intelligent, and that he built the world in an intelligent fashion. BYU is playing a leading role in deciphering the Tree of Life, and rightly so. Can you think of a better place to try and decipher the handiwork of God than at BYU? I give you my testimony that God is an intelligent creator, and as we try to learn more about the creation, we will indeed learn more about him. I am grateful for a creation which evokes such awe in all of us, and to be at an institution that allows me to study it in such detail. And I leave this testimony with you. In the name of Jesus Christ, amen.